Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 359 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 19th of January, 2018, as I record this. So today I have an interview on how to write diverse characters with Alex Anders, a timely topic since The Guardian UK recently reported that diversity is a trend in publishing this year. We talk about how to write diverse characters without cultural appropriation or stereotyping, as well as boundaries around language and an interesting discussion on gender fluidity. So a little content warning up front. There are no swear words, as far as I define swear words, but we do use language around anatomy and gender. And I know some people listen with kids, so although I'd consider it suitable for my nieces, as it would make an interesting conversation, you get to decide whether this conversation is suitable for whoever might be around you listening. I just wanted to say that up front. So in publishing news this week, related to publishing, I think, sort of marketing, but the new Goodreads giveaway system is now in place. So you might remember up until last week, it's been free to do a Goodreads giveaway and then you just pay for the books to send to people. But now you do have to pay to do a giveaway. Now they've got a 50% off special, so I thought I would try it out. So I've done one for Map of Shadows and one for Penny Appleton, Love Second Time Around, and I've done 100 ebooks. Now, what is good about the giveaways is that they automatically send those ebooks to the winners. So I'm very interested to see how that works. This ebook stuff has not been open to indie authors, I think, from outside the US or even just totally up until now. So I'm just going to see what happens. It's on half price, as I said, so I thought it would be worth trying, and I will report back on that. Also, kind of publishing, kind of futurist. Last week I mentioned the Kodak blockchain for photographers, which it turns out to be a bit of a dud, as reported by Money Week and also in the comments of last week's blog post. So it looks like that's one of those, yay, blockchain, oh dear, not so great, which is kind of the time of the industry I think we're in. But this week also saw the beginnings of possibilities for authors with the launch of Publica, PUBLICA.io, I think it is, which is an online platform that aims to be the first truly decentralized publisher by using blockchain technology to enable direct transactions between authors and readers. So this is very interesting, but I'm going to wait until the Alliance of Independent Authors releases their Blockchain for Books white paper, which they're doing at London Book Fair in April. Although I will be discussing this with Orna Ross, we do a monthly advanced salon. This month, we record on the last Tuesday of the month, and then it goes up on the Alliance of Independent Authors website and podcast feed. So I will be asking her about that. But certainly, it feels a bit like 2008 when Smashwords was sort of cutting edge in terms of ebooks, and things obviously then became mainstream with ebooks, and there were many more companies in the space. So interesting to watch what happens, but that Publica means that blockchain for authors is moving from futurist into now. So that's kind of a number of people commented about, you know, are some of these things just too far away to consider? Well, what I try and do, I guess, with my interest in this stuff is awareness, to make you aware of some of the possibilities that are going on. And yeah, sure, it might be a while before they become practical or a reality, but it's a bit like the, you know, the frog that gets put in the cold water and then it's slowly heated up and you don't notice and you don't notice and you don't notice, and then suddenly it's boiling around you and you've missed out. So that's kind of why I talk about it. It's interesting to see what's going to happen. On my personal update, I'm still working on the screenplay for Map of Shadows and really enjoying the challenge. And what's interesting, once again, what's so hilarious about my fiction under JF Penn is that I never, ever seem to be able to settle in a clear genre. And what's so funny is, a lot of people enjoying Map of Shadows, but a number of people have said to me, this is like a YA book, but it's kind of new adult. So does that make it new adult YA, which there is no category for, or or is it, you know, sort of a new adult fantasy horror? Like, where the hell does it fit? And what's interesting with the screenplay is the feedback I've had so far is you must come down on a genre. And it's much more important in the screenplay world because, you know, that's, you know, you have to be very clear as to where it fits. So interesting with that, what may end up happening, of course, is that I adjust the screenplay to fit a genre, and then we'll have to look at the book as to what I can do with that. I think it is YA in terms of when I look at the coming of age book, films like Divergent or Cassandra Clare's worlds, that's kind of where it fits to me. So yeah, hilarious once again. And this is evidence of the pros and cons of indie. You know, one, we can write whatever we like, but two, we can write whatever we like and there's no one to tell us that maybe we should alter it slightly to fit better in the market. So this is making me laugh, but I'm certainly learning a lot. I've also been reading a lot of scripts and fascinating to compare a movie script to the actual film. Even more fascinating when the writer is the director. So Tarantino, for example, who writes and directs, there are still scenes that are missing. So in his head, he can see it. And then when he actually makes the film, that disappears. It's not necessary. So that's fascinating to me. And yes, watching movies can be story research. Also, the recording of The Healthy Writer for audiobook is underway, and we have two awesome voices, my usual narrator, Carolyn Holroyd. So if you've listened to any of the other audiobooks like The Successful Author Mindset, which seems to be the most popular one, and Caroline is almost a voice doppelganger for me, I think. And amazingly, we have a new voice narrator whose name is Joe Penn. Yes, Joe Penn is a man and he's doing Ewan's voice and it's great. So I'm really happy with that. Obviously, how could I not hire him? His voice is a good, great voice as well, but I just thought that's awesome. So we'll be QAing it in the next week or so, and hopefully the audiobook for The Healthy Writer will be available by mid-end February, depending on, how ACX goes. Right, useful stuff. Okay, so Mark Lefebvre, previously known as Mark from Kobo, has a new podcast, Stark Reflections on Writing and Publishing. Now Mark is on the outside of a company. He can talk openly, I guess. And he has an interview with me on living the healthy writer life and other personal stuff, if you fancy that, because, of course, Mark and I have known each other for years now. And so we can have quite an interesting chat. Also, Mark has his own reflections on that site, and it's at starkreflections.ca. So that's cool. And another podcast, Ingram Spark, now has a podcast too. It's called Go Publish Yourself, which being British is an interesting inflection. But it looks very jolly and it includes episodes on ISBNs, metadata and how to sell your book into independent bookstores. And you can find that at ingramspark.com/podcast. And I'm definitely going to send questions about ISBNs to that because I am so over answering questions on ISBNs. I don't know why it becomes such an issue, but it does for some reason. So check that out. And of course, with so many new podcasts and more coming online every day, it's really important. It's a bit like with books. We have to consider how we are going to stand out, how we're going to continue to be original and differentiate ourselves. So, of course, I'll be continuing to share my personal journey along the way, as well as hopefully more advanced business stuff. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. I had over 40 comments on the blog post, which is amazing considering most of you listen on the podcast feed and don't leave comments. So very exciting to have comments on the blog post. And really great that you found the Mega Trends episode so useful and interesting. So thank you for listening. A few tweets from the week. Lee Tucker, taking advantage of a day off of work to finish the podcast and play in the snow. We don't get much of this in Georgia. And lovely pick there. Andrew Einsbrook sent a lovely baling picture, catching up on your podcast while loading a hay delivery for our sanctuary animals into the shed. That's lovely. Julie Cordoner, I listened while ironing, just had my mind blown. Thanks, Julie. And Cariad is actually, it's Monday night. I'm off to bed to listen to the show. And then just a couple more. Jana M. Floyd says, listening while shoveling 4 inches of snow in 2 degrees feels like minus 17 with wind chill. Wow, that's hardcore. And yeah, I think we'll leave it there. Right, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments. I really appreciate it. And it makes me feel like you're part of the show and keeps me energised. So tweet me at the Creative Pen with a double N, or you can leave a comment, or you can always email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from Christine in a minute. Thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Zoe Sadler, Amy Cesari, Jennifer Greenhall, and thanks to Olga and Catherine for upping their pledges this month. I really appreciate the Patreon support. Like your tweets and emails, it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month. And yeah, less than a coffee a month, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A, which I just recorded and sent out for January. And of course, if you do support the show, you get the whole backlist. So yes, you can get hours and hours of me answering questions, including questions about ISBNs, if you subscribe and support the show on Patreon at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Kobo Writing Life, and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hey, I'm Christine Monroe, the Senior Manager of Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free and easy self-publishing platform that helps authors like you reach millions of dedicated Kobo readers around the world. We're looking for new stories to feature on our blog and podcast, and we want to hear from you. Do you have an interesting pricing or marketing strategy that's working really well right now? Are you dedicated to publishing widely to all retailers? And how has that helped you grow your global fan base? Email us right now at writinglife@kobo.com with your ideas and some background information about you and your books, and you might get featured alongside huge indie bestsellers and industry experts. We cannot wait to hear from you. Back to you, Joanna.
Today, I'm here with Alex Anders. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Alex is an international best-selling author of romance and self-help with over 250 books published under multiple pen names. He's the host of the Bisexual Empowerment podcast and YouTube channel. And as an African-American bisexual male, Alex appears regularly in the media to speak about diversity, which is what we're talking about today, which is very exciting. And I'm really thrilled to have you on the show. So let's start with a definition, because the word diversity is kind of thrown around. Like, let's do diversity. But what is diversity in books and publishing as we're discussing it today?
Well, I think because the publishing industry tends to go towards authors who are white, who are straight, who are of European descent, I think for our discussion, diversity should be anything outside of that.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, let's just say up front, this is a fraught topic, isn't it? I mean, there are this, in terms of, I don't like this trigger thing, as in we shouldn't talk about certain things in case they trigger people, but this is a very political hot potato, especially in this political climate. So can we just, I guess, let's just say up front that our aim, you know, in this is to, present this in a very positive way and try to help people. You know, how have you come up against these kind of political hot potatoes in your career talking about this?
Well, you know, for me, it's actually, I got to say, it's a lot easier because I am a person who does not automatically fit into, you know, the norm. So I have always been the, like when I was an actor, I would look around on set and I would be the only Black person on set. And I went to a school in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin is the middle of the United States. And, you know, there are a lot of people who had never met a Black person before, and I was the first Black person they were meeting. So just in terms of life, the idea of being the diverse one just was always automatic. So it's just kind of second nature for me to deal with it. And I sometimes don't even see the differences anymore. I don't even feel when, you know, these unusual things come up in my career, in my life. But I can tell you, as a bisexual, that has, you know, been a bit of a challenge. But, you know, even that has been surprisingly easier and less confronting, if you will, than I would have guessed.
Mm. Well, you mentioned acting then. Just give us a little potted history of you know, how you got into writing and publishing.
Well, I started out a long time ago wanting to be a writer and wishing I can tell stories. And I thought the way to tell those stories would be to become an actor. After coming to Los Angeles and doing it for a while, I realized that being an actor is telling other people's stories. So I tried to figure out other ways I could, you know, tell stories. And through my career, I ended up doing things like I was a producer for Disney Channel, a promo writer producer for Disney Channel, for Toon Disney, for SoapNet, for Vivendi Universal Games for a while. And I made my living doing that for about 10 years or so. And then I started working at Disney Brand Marketing for Disney DVDs. And I was okay with it. It was interesting enough. But I really wanted to be in development. But in Disney, you can't really move up and down very easily. So I decided to do something radical, which was leave my job in order to be considered for like 3 development jobs that were coming up. Mm. I left my job, and then within a month, the president declared that we were in the middle of a recession and all those jobs I wanted went away. Mm. So I decided, well, what have I always wanted to do with my time? Now there won't be any new jobs coming up for like another year or so. And I thought, well, I've always wanted to write a book. Let me write a book. So I wrote one and then wrote 3 more. And at that point, I realized, okay, well, I'm not making a lot of money here. I wonder if there's a way I can make more money. And I did some research and I stumbled across someone by the name of Amanda Hawking, who I'm sure a lot of us, you know, everyone listening to this podcast.
Those of us
might
oldies remember Amanda Hawking.
Yes.
I'm not sure how many new people do. Yeah.
This is true. This is a good point. So back in about 2009, 2010, there was someone who's named Amanda Hawking, and she made big news because she signed, I think it was a $2 million deal to publish her indie books that she had been pushing digitally to a major publisher. And, you know, within that story, they were talking about how much she was making selling digitally. And I thought, what is digital? I don't know what that is. So I went, you know, did some research on her and found out that the way she kind of honed her skills and went from zero to, you know, selling a lot digitally was on a forum called Kindle Boards at the time. So I went looking for what that was, and I found it. And this was a forum where they just talked about, like, all day long, how to sell more books. These are a bunch of independent authors. And I spent hours and hours and hours on this researching what it is. And then I finally decided to change all my books from being print to being digital. And then I decided to just focus entirely on digital. Initially, like, I wrote 8 books initially, sold still basically nothing. And then I realized there was a bunch of people who were selling a bunch of books and they weren't talking about what they were writing. And they were writing the, you know, sexy form of romance. In which case I said, you know, if I ever get desperate, I mean, like, really desperate, because I'm an intellectual, I write smart books about, you know, intelligent things. If I ever get desperate, I'll try that. And then a month or two later, I got desperate. And the first book I wrote, I wrote it in a day. And I sold more in the next week with that one book that I did with my previous 8 books in the entire month. And I just switched. And from there, I just started selling more until finally, like within 7-8 months, I was making a living at it. And then it was just, you know, ever since then, I've been a professional author.
And we should just say up front that the that you were kind of joking with the desperate, as in romance authors, active romance authors and readers. We absolutely respect you all. and you know, we love you. You are the basis of our industry.
You know, the funny thing was that I've noticed that romance authors have a tendency to be on the cutting edge, like for whatever reason.
Absolutely. Well, because they get chucked off everything. They're like, oh, sorry, yeah, we can't have sex around here. So, we, you know, sorry, you're not allowed on our platform. So they've always had to be ahead of everybody. I totally agree with you. So, you know, where you were in that curve. But, that, you know, coming circling back to diversity. So are you writing only diverse romance, so bisexual romance, African-American romance, you know, or were you writing all kinds of romance?
Actually, no. I one thing I have learned very well in my life is that there's an audience and you play to that audience, and the audience for romance books are mostly white females. So as a Black male, I wanted to cater to the largest audience. So I wrote stories exclusively about white people. Like I made my living writing stories about a white female, sometimes, you know, slim figured, sometimes curvy, mostly curvy. And it has done very well. And that was what I knew sold not only in English, but it sold in multiple languages. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. It wasn't until, let's say, well, I started out writing the originally just generic erotica. And actually, no, first I started writing male on male erotica. Mm. Then I switched to when I realized that if I kept doing this, I would never date again because I mostly date women. I switched to like a 50 Shades of Grey. And then after that, I realized, well, there's actually more money to be made in like just sexy romance. So I switched to werewolf romance. Hmm. And that I did very well by that for a while. But then I thought, okay, well, actually there was a Kindle Unlimited switch and things started having to be longer. So I thought, you know what? I think I'll make the switch to suspenseful romance. Hmm. That's what I'll do. But it took me 7 months to learn how to do that, which meant 7 months of no income. And I like put all of my hopes into that, my first book, released it, and it completely failed. And I went, oh, geez, like either I can spend more time writing these books or I could like go back to what's tied, you know, what's true, which I've found to be successful, or I could try something else, which I do. And before that, I was doing my videos, which I do, videos, bisexual real talk. So there were videos aimed towards bisexuals and I was growing up an audience slowly but surely. And, you know, I'm kind of an active guy just in terms of and community building within the bisexual community. And I thought, well, if I'm doing all this stuff, why don't I also try writing bisexual romance? Let me see if there's an audience for that. And that's when I made the switch. Mm-hmm. And really, that's when I started selling the most of my career in English.
Wow. And what about the African Americans? Are you writing them yet?
Well, here's the interesting thing again. I'm from the Bahamas. So I grew up outside of the United States, and each of the genres, the reason why, you know, I work within the bisexual romance genre is that I understand the experiences that are, you know, most associated with that. So it becomes very easy for me to write about it. Mm. Growing up in the Bahamas is different from growing up in the United States. So, you know, and this is a tad bit of a stereotype, but not so much. I think the majority of African-American grow up in with an economic level that isn't as high as the average white person in America. Whereas I grew up in the Bahamas in a two-story house on a hill with a pool and a tennis court playing tennis with Sidney Poitier. So it wasn't exactly, you know, the equivalent experience. So when, if you were to write African-American romance, like what the readers are looking for are a deep dive into the African-American experience or a celebration of African-American culture within the dating community, like within the dating sphere. And I don't know if I know that. Like, I can do something and I can, you know, make the characters black, but, and that would certainly sell some books, but would I be able to like lock into the core reader group, readership of the African-American romance? So I've always kind of shied away from that, knowing that, you know, first of all, stories with white protagonists in it sell more. And that, you know, I have an understanding of middle-class white of America better than I do, you know, the typical African-American experience.
Mm. This is so interesting because we're talking about diversity and the assumption there is we're talking about white people writing people of different sexualities or race. And you're, you know, black guy writing, you know, white female, which I think is presumably cisgender, as we call it, and, you know, straight, which I think is brilliant. So let's talk about this in terms of the two extreme. I think there are two extremes for diversity, and you've basically covered both of them there, which is, first of all, which, and this is mainly the one I do, which assume people are people and that, you know, I have enough in common with an African-American woman growing up in a very poor place, but she still experiences love. She still experiences yes. grief. People are people, yeah. whatever color, sexuality, gender, whatever. And then there's the other extreme, which you mentioned, which is the deep dive into a cultural situation where that becomes the heart of the book. And that is where the cultural appropriation issues can come. It's like, how can a white woman living? Well, I got it actually today as we're talking. Someone emailed me and said, how can I write about some of the things I do when I live in Bath, which is like this white heartland in Britain? You know, even though I went to school in Africa, Malawi, in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, I've traveled around the world. I've got, you know, my family is multicultural. I was so offended. I was just like, ah, but this is the thing. It's these two extremes seem like a problem. So how can we balance writing multicultural, writing diversity, whoever we are, and not being accused of cultural appropriation?
Well, you know, honestly, I don't think there's a way you can avoid being accused of something. There, people in this world are sensitive, sometimes rightfully so, sometimes not rightfully so. Mm. And we, if you live life fearlessly, you are going to eventually be accused of something. And it's a matter of whether or not you take it on and change because of it or not. And it's like, when should I take it on and when should I change because of it and when shouldn't I take it on? But, or should I change for it? But the really thing is that this will just happen. This stuff will, you know, people will just say what they say. Mm. But the question is like, when should an author for their own moral self decide, you know, what is too much? What is, you know, dancing on stereotypes and stuff like that? I think really the guide that an author should follow is, yes, people are just people. And the thing is, like, and I talk about my experience, like I do not have the typical African-American experience, yet I'm a black man living in America. So I am by definition African-American. So if you were to take a white character and just make their complexion black, that is diversity. Mm. And that is not saying that, you know, that's not doing anything wrong. That's not just like, you know, cheating or anything like that, because you can always find someone who is like that.
Yeah.
And you're just representing someone from that class, from that whatever else, who just happens to be black.
Yeah. I think it's the same with gender. Like, people say to me, or how can I write male characters? I'm like, well, I just write them as I write a woman and I just give them a male name. Like, I probably do what you say. Like, I'm like writing a thriller in India, so I give my character an Indian name, and, you know, but I don't have them like wobble their head or, you know, talk like that. So I think I sit on that side, which is, I think at base, people are people. But what was your other extreme there? I interrupted you.
No, the other thing is that, you know, there's the idea of trying to do a deep dive when you don't have the experiences necessary to do it. Mm. So if you are, let's say, and again, if you write African-American romance, you don't have to do the deep dive. But, you know, it certainly helps with readership. So if you try to do it and your experiences of, let's say, the culture you're writing about is just some sort of random, you know, well, I know him from TV or I know him from movies or from what I hear, you can rest assured that you will absolutely be writing a stereotype.
Yeah.
Because that is the way the human brain works. Like when we're a child, someone gives us a tennis ball and says, this is a ball. And then the child goes, okay, so yellow, fuzzy, and small. Those are balls. And that's not bad. That's creating a stereotype, and that's not bad. But if, you know, the parent then handed them a basketball and said, this is a ball too. And the kid said, no, no, that is not a ball too. All balls are yellow, fuzzy, and small.
Yeah.
Then there's a problem. So creating the stereotype isn't a problem. So if you meet like another group and you go, okay, so everyone from this group is this, this, and this. As long as when you meet someone else or you have other experiences and kind of broaden what you think of that group is, then it's not a problem. But if you don't have those multiple experiences to extend out your, you know, your initial stereotype of the group, then it's a problem. And if you are writing a book and, you know, having a lot of your book being about the culture of whatever, and you haven't expanded like that, then you can just rest assured you're writing a stereotype.
You're getting it wrong. And that sort of begs the question about research. So I was circling back to India, which is, you know, I've been to India a number of times. I love it. In Britain, we have a lot of Indian influence. And when I was writing Destroyer of Worlds, I spent a lot of time on YouTube because the biggest thing for me there was getting the religion right. So of course, we mentioned race, sexuality, gender. Religion is a hell of a prospect because, again, you separate an African-American Muslim in an inner city with like your life in the Bahamas. Again, it's very different. So I watch YouTube videos, but in a deep sense. So like very specifically around a tiny, like what would this type of shrine look like? And then try and use those details. Also, I read a lot of, books around that. So tango dancing, I was trying to get a character on tango dancing and read a book about that. Or refugees, I was reading refugee stories written by refugees. So what are some of the other ways that you would recommend researching characters so we don't have stereotypes?
Well, I know in terms of research, the thing I do most often, and this is going to sound, you know, kind of flat, but I go to Google Earth or Google Maps, and I choose an actual location for my sets, and I actually like walk through them so I can get a sense of what it feels like to be in that exact space. YouTube, I think, would be the best possible way, because on YouTube, you can not only find, like, if you're looking through religions and stuff like that, you could very easily find stuff on religion. But more than that, there are videos where they talk about, you know, the 10 things that are, you know, 10 things are unique about dating, like a Russian woman or something like that, or a Greek guy and stuff like that. So you get a sense of from someone who is from probably your culture and the things they see that are different, or from someone who left their culture and came to your culture and the things they notice that are different. So by watching like those specific types of videos, you get a sense of how a person from the culture you're writing about kind of the differences they see. Mm. And that helps you to understand the things you can add to your character that would make it a little bit more fleshed out. But YouTube in all of its forms, I think, is the best possible way. Yes, you can do documentaries. You know, yes, you can like read stories on stuff like that. But if you want to see a person and just see how they react and just kind of see the way they interact with the world, YouTube is, I think, by far the best.
Yeah, me too. And on language, so because writing dialogue, I think this is one of the worst things that authors do. And not even on a, let's just do it on a country specific thing. Like I have a friend who wrote an Irish character, and then the audiobook, it was like a leprechaun. He was like, to be sure. And it was like, no, Irish people don't speak like that, you know, or an Indian person with the kind, you know, again, the stereotype. Right. And I mean, you can also really be offensive. I mean, obviously, there are words in the African-American culture that African-Americans can use with each other that you can't use if you're not an African-American. It's just not acceptable. But there will be people who want to write dialogue that represents those characters. And you can see how this becomes an issue, because we want to be sometimes you don't want to describe somebody, you know, in exactly the right way, but you want to use some language that respects their culture. So where do you think the lines are around dialogue that might, again, be just totally cliche or wrong, you know, morally wrong?
Well, this is, again, so many interesting, complex topics here. Mm. I grew up, as I'm sure you did, with Quentin Tarantino and Pulp Fiction. So, and Quentin Tarantino has a tendency to be comfortable with certain words to describe Black people. Mm. And he feels comfortable with that because he grew up around a lot of Black people and with a high appreciation of Blaxploitation cinema from the 70s. So that's kind of my background on it and what I had to kind of come to terms with how people are allowed to use words if they don't exist in the culture. And I think nowadays I would say lean on being fearless. However, don't be a lazy writer. Mm. So if you're going to use the words that's going to offend somebody, ensure that you have done as much research as you possibly can so that you're not creating that stereotype, so that you've expanded your understanding of culture in such a way that you can use it in the way that it is actually used in real life. As long as you stick to those rules, I think in terms of morally, you can be okay. Mm. And as an author, it's almost your responsibility to be fearless and to kind of push a little bit. But again, don't be a lazy writer. Make sure that you've done your research and understand what you're using, because words are powerful.
Yeah. And I think the other thing just on words is, you know, I'm 43. I'm 43, mm-hmm. Not quite yet. I'm almost 43. And what I'm finding so interesting just on gender, I mean, we've talked about sexuality, which is different to gender. And what is so interesting, I'm finding this non-binary gender thing fascinating, and this cisgender, which this word is quite new, I think, well, at least in my experience, transgender, intersex, you know, but particularly I was talking to some, you know, and the difference that younger generations have around the understanding of gender fluidity, which I love. Like, I didn't even know I had a choice to be more fluid around these things.
Who did? I didn't.
Yeah, exactly, who did? And I really love that. But what's interesting is, and again, the language, I almost feel like sometimes I love the fact that we're making up new language. I think that's the point I'm trying to get to. And yet I hear people who are my age and older using them in the wrong way. Like I heard an older relative of mine say, oh, I want to watch that program with the gay. And I'm like, what is the gay? And she's like, and she meant Graham Norton's show, which are very popular. And she didn't, she didn't mean it in an offensive way. It was just the word, but it could be taken in an offensive way. So what do you think, you know, around these, the necessity to learn and understand the way people are using these words and then make, I mean, it becomes quite silly if we get down to a sort of, you know, I'm a cisgender African-American male Muslim, you know what I mean? How far do we go
absolutely.
With this?
Well, I think you go as far as is necessary to accommodate your world. So, like, you don't have to know the intricacies of how a computer works to go about your life. So there's no need to really deep dive into that and to completely understand that. If your world is kind of small and isolated, then you technically don't need these words. But if your world is expanding, if you are, you know, interacting with a lot of younger people, if you're an author and you want to tackle, like, you know, try and do something that isn't just kind of straight white male, you know, from European descent sort of thing, then it's necessary for you to go into it and understand it a little bit. But I have something for your audience, some tips of what these words mean, like the just kind of like the basis of it and how authors can use it in an interesting way.
Great.
So I have a YouTube channel about bisexuality. So I deal with sexuality a lot. And I think First of all, there's sexual orientation and sexual identity. Sexual orientation has to do with who you have fantasies about, who your behavior is with, and who you fall in love with. So it's kind of like a scientific stuff you can look at. And there's only three. People argue there's more, but there's only three according to science, which is heterosexual, homosexual, and bisexual. And then there's sexual identity. And identity is how you want to present yourself to the world. So, for example, there could be a person who is, their sexual orientation is really bisexual, but because of cultural whatever, because of, you know, fear of reactions, they could identify as straight. So in that way, you have this kind of conflict going on. So the reason why I really now love writing bisexual characters so much, because, you know, writing is about writing conflict. And internal conflict is key. And when I write about bisexuals, I can constantly dance with the conflict of this is how they really are. And this is how they present themselves to the world. And what conflict comes about because of that. So when dealing with like the sexual identity, sexual orientation thing, those are the major differences. And for sexual identity, that's where you get straight as a sexual identity, gay as a sexual identity, bisexual, pansexual, queer,
asexual,
all these things. Asexual is different. Asexual, there is the spectrum of who you're attracted to. And then there's the scale of how strong is your sexual desire. So psychologists will put that on two separate scales. So it's not a sexual orientation as it is kind of a clarification, a deepening of one's sexuality. So asexual exists on a scale of how much you're attracted, and it goes from hypersexual to asexual. So that's slightly something different. In terms of like trans and non-binary and stuff like that, those are all words that exist in a spectrum of, or two different categories, which is sex and gender. Sex is all about the biology. It's about what genitals you were born with and what chemicals are being released in your body at particular ages and stuff like that. It's all about sex. And now there's, you know, there's officially two, but now expanding on, there's like a third, like, which is currently more like an other, because there's just so many variations on it. So it's male, female, and currently other, and other people might use different words. But then there's gender, and gender is how do you feel? Like, do you feel whatever your individual society or your individual culture describes as male? Describes as female. And again, with the identities, there are different identities within that. So there's male, there's female, there's I feel trans. Intersex is more of closer on the lines of sex, because intersex has to do with what your biology is, and it not kind of completely conforming to all things male, all things female. So you might, you know, your genitals might not be completely clear in terms of what they are. But in terms of writing about someone within that sphere, creating a conflict between what their sex is and how they feel is another thing you can kind of tap into to just get the interesting stuff about diversity and exploring past, you know, the straight world and kind of clear of what the differences are between all of them.
Yeah, and that's I find it so interesting. I mean, I did gender studies within psychology when I studied psychology, and you know, I think it is so interesting, as you say. And like I write a female action hero who is, you know, he's kind of presenting as male in so many ways, because, you know, she's basically James Bond, but a female James Bond, because in the white action hero, it's usually a man, you know. So this can go on so many levels. And I still, you know, I think I write diverse characters all the time, and I still kind of come back to, at the end of the day, that person, whatever their external and internal things, will still love will still grieve,
yeah.
You know, will still look for a home unless they're a psychopath. And the personality, I mean, you know, there's a lot of books about psychopaths, so that's fine. But you know, let's just talk. I just wanted to mention The Guardian on the 31st of December, 2017, said that diversity in publishing is a trend for 2018, which I thought was really interesting. And you had said, it is a smart business decision for authors to include diverse characters. Now, I think it's a bit sad that we have to say that it's a trend in publishing, because it should be just part of publishing. But do you think that this push, and obviously we've got a lot of movements that are going on right now in our this point in history that are trying to bring more diversity, do you think that this will stop being an issue? Or, you know, how much will this become part of the industry, or will it always feel like something we have to talk about?
No, I think things are changing. I think things are always changing and always getting better. But I think that article had a point to what they were saying, but for a reason. I think there's a very specific reason why 2018 is and not 2017 and 2016. Three reasons. First one being that the generations are changing. The experiences of people growing up, it's just expanding. So we are of the same generation. There is a generation behind us, the millennials. And I think the millennials grew up with race, like diversity in race being standard. Because of rap music, it just became everywhere. Because TV shows were beginning to be more diverse when they were growing up, because of, I guess, MTV is less now, but still back when millennials were there, it's still kind of a big thing. And because of all these things, the millennials have grown up with, no, you know, diversity is just kind of expected. That's just what it is. And now they've started making content for themselves, and it reflects that. And then the generation behind them, which is Generation Z, they're growing up with sexual diversity the same way millennials grew up with racial diversity. So if you want to write books that these readers can relate to, though, you have to start thinking about diversity. And you'll always sell books if you don't include diversity. But the stickiness factor of those generations, like, for example, I am a lover of an author whose name is B.V. Larson. He writes sci-fi, and I read a lot of sci-fi authors. But the first time I read one of his books, you know, the first chapter, aliens come to Earth. Sadly, they kill his children, grab him, put him on the spade. And then he has to battle to survive. And the person that he had to battle was a Latina woman. And he fights her off and wins. And then she gets thrown off the spaceship. But he tells the spaceship to grab her and help her and repair her. And they become romantic interests. And it's like, when you're not white and you're reading books, when you see a character, a main character that is anything other than white, you have a tendency just to go, what? So I saw this and I kind of went, wait, what just happened here? Mm-hmm. And from that point forward, like his best friend was black, and all these other racial diverse groups were added to the story. And as a non-white reader, you kind of just go, oh, I like this. I really like this. So if you want that stickiness, and I've read about 13 or 15 of his books, in part because I can relate to stuff. If you want that stickiness with your readership, then you probably should try and make the world better reflect the world of the upcoming generations, because those are new readers. That's one big thing. But I think also, specifically 2018 versus 2017-16, this is a kind of a broader historical thing. And I'm going to use American history, since it's what I'm most familiar with. So there was a civil war in the United States, which was the war against the North against the South, and it was a war over slavery. Lincoln fought the war, freed the slaves, and right after that happened, there was a group created called the Ku Klux Klan. It's an American group. It's like a white supremacist group in the United States.
I would hope that most people have heard of that.
I would hope to. But I'm sure your viewers are from all over the world. So there's the Ku Klux Klan, and they existed for a number of decades until the rest of society came down and squashed them and quieted them, and they went away for a while. So then that remained for another couple decades until about 1940s, where there was a lot of Italian immigration into the United States, and them plus the Jews plus the blacks caused the Ku Klux Klan to decide they had to have a second wave. And then they did. And that lasted for a slightly shorter time, and then the rest of society came down and squashed that. And they remained quiet again until the 1960s, when there was the civil rights movement going on, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. And then there was a third wave of the Ku Klux Klan. And again, society came together and kind of squashed them down. And what happened? What did we just come out of in 2016? It was the first African-American president in the history of America. And what happened right afterwards? Well, we had our first president who openly said derogatory things about other races and had made his career off of saying that the first black president wasn't born here. And then we had Charlottesville, where the people who of the Ku Klux Klan, the white supremacist group, once again had they felt empowered, and they again came to the forefront. So what happened throughout all of history? Society has come together again to silence that voice. And I think that with everyone, readers tend to be a little bit more liberal simply because when you read, you find out about other people's worlds. So readers see those things like in Charlottesville, there was that rally in Charlottesville, and go, that's really icky. And if you watch a TV show that just has all white people on it, or just read a books that just have all nothing but white culture, it's kind of like, that's icky. Oh, and that TV show I'm watching kind of reflects the philosophy of that ickiness over there. And this book I read is just nothing but that. Maybe I should look for something a little bit more broader. Mm. And because of that kind of historical trend, people nowadays have a tendency to look for things that are slightly more diverse and does not reflect the ickiness of what's going on in society today. So because of that trend, I think it is, for 2018, a good idea to present things that make readers feel good for reading it, as opposed to having it reflect the attitude of, that we don't want it in society.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I don't know if this was Martin Luther King, but that the arc of the moral universe tends towards the good. I think that was that Martin Luther King, I think?
I think so. It's long and bends towards justice.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, like it's all good, but we're moving towards the good. And I was thinking about that around Netflix, because what's so interesting around Netflix and the streaming media and ebooks, the ease of finding ebooks, is that readers have a chance to actually seek out these more diverse, different things that they want to watch or read, and they can find them, and they're being produced now. Whereas the publishing industry, which certainly in Britain, they've had reports on it, is very, very white, straight dominated, university educated, but now, because of self-publishing, people can publish the books they want. I mean, Wattpad is so interesting. Wattpad, we're talking about, young Muslim women writing stories about, love stories, what that means within a Muslim culture, which is so different to what you or I would be used to.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah, exactly. And that is absolutely fascinating. So I love this. I think this is such an interesting angle. And in a way, it shouldn't be. But I think we all have to be responsible for saying, yes, let's try. And just instead of just instinctively picking a character just like us, is to try and think a bit deeper about who that character could be. And as you say, use that for conflict. Within my own family, we have several mixed race marriages across, racial and religious diversity just within my siblings. And, it, you know, of course, when you come from different cultures, there are going to be conflicts, but yet love is there. So, I think this is so important.
And I don't even think, like, yes, it's absolutely important. And morally speaking, it's probably something you should be thinking about as an author. But just looking at it from an author perspective, like the fun of writing is coming up with conflicts and kind of resolving those conflicts and diving into the experiences of, you know, interacting with different races and different sexual orientations and stuff like that. It's like a gold mine. In the United States, I've been noticing just so many more bisexual characters ending up on television shows. And honestly, I don't think it's because TV writers are saying, hey, this is something different, whatever else. I think it's generally because when a person really stops and thinks about it, like writing about bisexuality or a bisexual character, how much more interesting is it that that character can fall in love with that person, which is, you know, which let's say the opposite gender, which is pretty standard and stuff like that. But then you can have that same character later on fall for that one over there. There's just so much you can explore, so much you can do with it. It just becomes so much more of an option to one, to a person as a writer. And I think more and more writers are starting to realize that and hence making more and more characters bisexual, because it just opens up this whole new world of what you can explore and, you know, stuff that people haven't seen before.
Yeah, fantastic. Right. So where can people find you and your books and your YouTube channel and everything you do online?
You can go to one place, alexandersbooks.com. There I have all of my books listed. I also have all my social media, so you can find my YouTube channel and you can find all that stuff there.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Alex. That was great.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm glad you invited me and I appreciate it so much.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Alex today and that it will help you write more diverse characters in future. Coming up next week, I have an interview on successful self-publishing tips with Stephen Spatz from BookBaby, since BookBaby have just released a survey on the most successful self-publishers and what they have in common. So really interesting. Have a wonderful writing week and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.